A controversial prisoner exchange, a bizarre crime in Waukesha, and a slate of candidates for the 2014 elections. Just some of the stories we'll discuss in this edition of The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Should the U.S. have exchanged five Taliban detainees for an American soldier being held by the Taliban? What do you make of the criticism of President Obama for doing so? Waukesha prosecutors are considering trying two 12-year-old girls who are suspected of stabbing another to please a fictional internet character in adult court for attempted murder. We'll talk about that. Should these two 12-year-old suspects be tried as adults for this crime? And do you care who is going to be on the Wisconsin primary ballots in August following this week's deadline for the candidate nomination papers to be turned in? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Just three of the stories that we'll be talking about with our 2 week in review guests. Let me welcome them now. Brian Fraley is a conservative consultant. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Peg Lautenschlager is with us, former Democratic Attorney General of Wisconsin, a former state legislator, and a former United States attorney and attorney now with Bauer and Bach. Good morning.
Morning, Joy. Good morning, Brian.
Well, good morning.
Yeah, Brian, welcome to The Week in Review. You have been on other shows before. We'll have you on a somewhat regular basis on our Week in Review. Let's talk about this this story where the U.S. exchanged the five Taliban detainees who were being held in Guantanamo for the American soldier, the sergeant being held by the Taliban, and all of the criticism that has resulted from that. What do you make of this first, Brian? Should Obama have made this prisoner swap?
No, I think, first of all, we're glad Sergeant Bird goes home, regardless of his status as deserter or AWOL or whatever. An American serviceman is home, and that is good, and it's not to be discounted. But I share Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein's concern that the swap, if we want to call it that, was totally not following the law. And like her, I'm very dismayed about it. This wasn't didn't follow the proper procedure, and there seems to be an evolving story as to why Congress wasn't notified. At first it was because of his health, and now they're saying it's because, they were threatened to kill him if they didn't go through with this. I think it's going to be several months before we find out all the specifics of it.
Peg, do you think this was the right thing to do?
One, I think it was the right thing to do. As to the notification of Congress issue, I think that that's something we need to explore. I think Obama was in a sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't position. If you look at, previous prisoner releases, including well over 500 by George Bush, including one where we think the guy was involved in Benghazi. Not a lot of ado has been made of those sorts of things, and yet the five prisoners who were released, suddenly this becomes this huge political issue, and I think that's the sad part of this, is the politicization of the issue itself prior to really sorting out all the facts. As to the notification issue, I find it funny. I mean, we live in this, highly partisan age. It seems that one thing that always rings true is no matter who the elected official, there seems to be this notion of once they're in a particular position, they believe that they have a lot of power. You know, you look at our governor, Scott Walker, who as a county exec was all about local control until he became governor, and now all of a sudden he's about state control. You have Barack Obama, who as a senator was concerned about the power of the executive branch, but now that he's the leader of that branch of government, he's using his commander-in-chief powers to make this release. As to the notification and Bergdahl's health, we're going to have to see the one video which ostensibly ostensibly Sarah Bergdahl drugged. I can see that if he made some sort of statements to Congress, if something got leaked, whatever happened, then they'd be saying, here we have this American who's drugged, who knows what's happening to him. So, like you say, I think there was going to be criticism from the right and also from members of Congress, no matter which way he played it. And I think he seems comfortable, at least, in how he did it, and I don't think he needs to apologize in terms of the release.
Well, the Intelligence Committees were briefed on the Intelligence Committees were briefed on the Bin Laden raid before it happened.
Right.
We trusted the Democrats and Republicans, members of Congress, with that sensitive information that if that would have leaked, would have been far more devastating than if this would have leaked.
So I think so, too.
There's a lot of politics involved here, and I think the American people are right to be skeptical as to the timing of why now, especially with the mounting scandals that the Obama administration is facing. Why now was this so important?
But if it was, first of all, I think why now is because we're getting out of Afghanistan, and this is what you do at the end of a war. But I do think, though, Brian, that when you look at what's going on with now, I don't see what the incentive was for Obama not to tell congressional leaders. So to say that this was some devious, intentional oversight on the part of the administration, it just doesn't make sense. It's like,
I'm not an attorney, you are, but you know that the motive for not following the law doesn't necessarily matter if you break the law.
Well, it depends on what the charge is. I'm just saying that I don't think there was intentional oversight. I think that there was, if it wasn't being done, it was not being done for reasons. And we don't know what those are yet.
Well, Brian, why do you think the timing is suspect?
Well, as you look at the mounting scandals that are plaguing this administration, and it's not just partisan scandals. These are Democrats very concerned about things. Let's just take the VA, for example. He's taking a lot of heat from veterans groups, and rightfully so, for the administration's dereliction of duty to the men and women of this country who have served with honor and distinction and have come back in serious need of medical help. As the veterans groups get upset, what better way to, you know, get a jolt in the arm than bring back an American serviceman who's been ostensibly held captive for 5 years?
Oh, Brian.
And I think it was a miscalculation.
The VA issues have been going on for decades. They've been going on under both George Bushes as well as Bill Clinton. They have to do with numbers. They have to do with a number of people with PTSD who haven't been treated. And the great escalation in people returning from tours of duty and multiple tours of duty. This isn't something that the Obama administration brought on.
Yeah, but is he waving?
Under the Obama administration, the fudging of numbers for the wait time so that the employees could still get bonuses, that's a new development.
Let's not talk about the veteran scandal, but what about Brian's theory that the president did this to take the heat off of him with that VA scandal pick?
I just don't think that that's the case. I mean, my sense is that he wants to get these things accomplished, and when a break comes where it's an opportunity to do so, he's accomplished them. I remember when the Bin Laden death happened, there were those saying, why did it take so long? Why did he wait until the time that he did? I mean, there's always going to be questioning, and I just don't see this as an issue. Why would you create an issue as hot as this one is becoming in order to get away from the VA?
Let's take a call from Jonathan in Milwaukee. Hello, Jonathan.
Hi, Joy. How you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
I spent a couple of years in Afghanistan with an intelligence agency targeting specifically the types of guys who were released. And I have to say that I do agree that the trade should have been made. I don't think that I think Bo Bergdahl needs to be held responsible for what he did. But I do think it was the right thing to do. I don't think there are any good guys traded around, but I also don't want, you know, one of the speakers kind of undermine the value of these five guys. These weren't, you know, 17-year-olds who were, you know, shooting rifles at American convoys. These were guys with 40, 50, 60 years of combat experience, training from various countries around the world, and these were really these are the McChrystal equivalents or Petraeus equivalents of the insurgent body. And so while I think it's good that we release them, because it will take, I don't know, maybe 18, 24 months for them to end up back in, you know, Yemen or somewhere where we can kill them again and taxpayers don't have to subsidize their captivity. I don't think it was a bad thing, but I do think that Goldberg Dahl needs to be held accountable for the soldiers who died looking for him.
Brian.
Especially with someone who's been there and done that, and I have tremendous respect, and thank you, sir, for your service. Look, the situation at Guantanamo Bay is troubling, right? It's troubling for all Americans. It's a situation we're dealing with a force that is not tied to a country. They don't wear a uniform, and we don't treat them like normal prisoners of war. We don't have a typical military style of justice, and we're not treating them in American courts per se. And so this has been a troubling issue over two presidencies, two separate parties. And it was very clear and very evident that these five particular senior high-level, the equivalent of four-star generals for the Taliban, were the most troubling components of the plan to close Guantanamo, the Camp X-ray at Guantanamo Bay, right? They were the, what do we do with these guys? We can get rid of the other people. We can house them elsewhere. We can send them back to their countries. But what do we do with these five guys? And this was an opportunity to say, well, here's a solution. We'll just get rid of them. And when the idea was first floated to members of Congress well over 2 years ago, members from both parties expressed grave concerns that a deal like this and the precedence that it takes place, does it put a target on the back of service members overseas saying you can get high-value targets back if you take one of our guys?
Peg?
First of all,
we have funny connections going on here. I'm not sure what.
I'm getting an echo, Joy.
I am too. Can Peg go?
No, it's better. Okay. No, it's better. As to the question, it seems to me as though, first of all, I don't think that these so-called high-value targets are as high-value as some would like to express. Number two, if we look at the history of who's been released and whether or not we believe through our intelligence communities or through international or other international GMOs, that indeed about 17% of those released at most return to terrorist activities. Another maybe 12% are suspected. All of those were released under the Bush administration, but for one. So to make it sound as though, that this is unprecedented in terms of our release of individuals who may return to terrorist activities, no, it isn't unprecedented. It's something that happens when you have prisoner exchanges, when you have wars that end. I agree with Brian that, indeed, these conflicts, these wars, have been this sort of hybrid thing where the U.S., and we've been doing this since Vietnam, aren't quite sure how we're going to, describe what we are doing when it comes to military presence and fighting. And as a result of that, we end up with these bizarre situations where it isn't a typical prisoner of war or whatever else. But either way, you know, when wars end, prisoners get released, and that's what's happening now. As to the caller, I appreciate his interesting remarks on this, and I certainly appreciate his service as well. And so for that, we owe him thanks, and I'm happy he called in today.
We are talking with Peg Lautenschlager and Brian Fraley today during this edition of our Week in Review. We'll talk some more about a couple of related items to the controversial prisoner exchange, where the U.S. Exchanged five Taliban detainees for American soldier Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. And we'll talk about some other top stories of the week, including that bizarre stabbing in Waukesha, and lots of state political news with nomination papers from candidates who want to run in the 2014 election being due this week. And we'll welcome any other issues you want to talk about. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network. Mm-hmm. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking today with two guests from different perspectives about the top news stories of the week. And we're welcoming your input, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Well, you know, on a somewhat of a side story here, Fox host Bill O'Reilly is taking some heat for comments he made about Bo Bergdahl's father. He said that Bo Bergdahl's father looked like a Muslim. He defended his words this past week on The O'Reilly Factor. Let's take a listen.
A, he absolutely looked like a Muslim. B, he talked in Pashto, the language of the Taliban. And C, he thanked Allah. I thought his appearance was totally inappropriate. I said it. I'll stand by it.
So, Brian Fraley, what does that matter? What does this matter? What do you make of this?
No, what he looks like doesn't matter. The fact that he spoke in Pashto and praised Allah was odd because there's been no indication previously that was the faith by which, they were living. And there was some concern that maybe this was even part of the deal that, as a sign. But of all the things that, are troubling about this, I think that is the smallest and easiest to dismiss, and I think it just detracts from some of the actual more serious concerns about the whole situation.
Mm-hmm. Peg?
I'm glad to hear Brian say that. First of all, I'm not quite sure what a Muslim looks like. There are
right,
plenty of people who look like
hunter.
That, and I know a lot of Muslims who don't look like that, so I'm not quite sure what a Muslim looks like, and I think it's too bad. I mean, because essentially what Bill O'Reilly's doing is politicizing something which isn't. We don't know all the facts. Unfortunately, we're in a media age where everybody has to jump in right away. We don't know the facts, as you say, Brian, and the reality is it's not that important. And it's interesting to me because I think his comments diminish from what's becoming the so-called conservative side of the arguments about the deal. And, it gives people like me a lot of ammunition to say, my gosh, this guy is stereotyping to the nth degree.
Well, let's kind of wrap this one up. Where do you see this going, Peg? In terms of is it going to go away or is it going to stay with the president for a while?
Oh, I'm sure it's going to stay through at least the November elections. I presume Congress, and probably bipartisanly so, will do something in terms of investigating what's going on in terms of the notice. And that's my sense.
Yeah, Brian.
Yeah, I think this is just another example of the imperial presidency, where Barack Obama, frustrated by a Congress where he sees that he can't get things done, does things on his own. So that just feeds the appetite of people who want to rein in the executive branch, and these are people from both parties. So I think that this has a shelf life long beyond the elections. I think that this could, as we find out more information about this, this could be a defining moment in Obama's legacy and not in a good way.
Well, speaking of President Obama, he is in Normandy. He says American commitment to liberty is written in blood on the beaches of Normandy, and it endures with a new generation, honoring the World War II veterans who were a part of D-Day on the anniversary of D-Day. Any just general thoughts on this, the 70th anniversary of the D-Day invasion, Brian?
Yeah, my thanks to all those who have served, including those that are still alive that served in World War II. My father passed 10 years ago. He was a Navy veteran. He served mostly in the Pacific, but he talked about what D-Day meant. He didn't talk about the war a lot. He never talked about what he did. But he told me once about what D-Day meant to all of those serving. It was like the first giant, we are here. We are coming back, the Americans, the British. We're fighting the tyranny of the Nazis, and we're going to win. And it was such a massive undertaking. And, in wars past, the side that wins takes land. Even the Soviets did in after World War II. The only land that the Americans took was the land we needed to bury our dead. And I think back to President Reagan at the 40th anniversary of Normandy, and now with President Obama there on the 70th anniversary, it is a sign of our humanity that we continue to recognize the sacrifice that so many people made in such a global effort. We can't comprehend this, and sometimes I shudder to think about how World War II would have gone had we been in this 24-hour news cycle with social media and cable news and everyone having to comment on every single aspect without knowing the facts. But I just thank God for their service, and you know, I know that Europe does too. They don't always recognize it, but Europeans will. You know, they drive past those cemeteries too, and they know the cost that this nation bore.
Peg?
Yeah, I too have a dad who was in the military at that time. He too in the Navy, and was stationed on ships in both theaters. But the one thing, Brian, you remarked about, which holds true for me too, is that my dad didn't talk about the war much. A couple of times he talked about being in Japan after the nuclear bomb was, Hiroshima occurred. But there's a certain kind of notion that this was duty and that this is something which had to be done and was done, and now enough said. And I think sometimes, and maybe it is the 24-hour news cycle, that creates this kind of hysteria and complicates issues in ways that I think sometimes are unfair, and are unfair especially to our soldiers and sailors. And it is a time to look back at when, you know, partisanship didn't matter as it does, where these sorts of issues were national issues and not one side versus the other. And I think it should be serving us as a reminder of what we can do when we act in a united fashion and find commonality.
This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Peg Lautenschlager and Brian Fraley, and with you if you'd like to join in. We're going to talk about next that stabbing in Waukesha, where two 12-year-old girls are accused of stabbing a friend 19 times, trying to please, reportedly, a fictional internet character. It's getting national attention, this story, and it's also there's also a controversy over whether these two 12-year-old suspects ought to be tried in adult court. Waukesha County prosecutors are saying that that's likely what they are going to do. Should they be tried in adult court? What do you think? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. So, Peg, what do you think? Do these two, first off, your general comments on this very, very bizarre story coming out of Waukesha?
I don't know that I can say anything more than very, very bizarre story. Needless to say, I've spent a fair amount of my life as a prosecutor, and this really goes beyond many bizarre crimes I have seen, or alleged crimes I have seen. Frankly, Joy, despite my being characterized as liberal when I was a district attorney in Winnebago County, I waived the first 14-year-old into adult court for a first-degree homicide in the history of the state. So I've been in Brad Schimmel's shoes, and have had to make that decision at the time we had to go to court and have a hearing as to whether or not waiver was appropriate, and the court did find that waiver was appropriate. It's a hard decision to make, and I guess if I'm to be critical, and I'm not being critical, I don't want to be critical, but your show asks me to evaluate, but one, I don't envy anybody who has to make that decision. But number two is, I do think, though, that when making that decision, it is far more complex than just, was this crime cold-blooded, attempted murder, or whatever. And in this case, there are a lot of complexities that certainly didn't exist for mine. I had a situation with a 14-year-old who stabbed an elderly woman to death. multiple stabbings again, also evidence of a rape that took place at the time of the killing. And it was somebody who had already been in juvenile detention center who had had a history from the time he was 6 years old, if I recall correctly, of committing crimes. And a lot of crimes against people involving sexual violence, things like that. That is a much easier decision to make than this situation where you've got two young girls, and this may sound sexist, but I think girls at those ages tend to have issues that boys don't always face, although sometimes do. And the situation here is more not the kid who's always committing crimes, but rather children who probably are living in this fantasy world in order to avoid a reality which is hard on them. And so making that decision is going to be no easy task, and I hope that as District Attorney Schimmel makes that decision, that he does so thoughtfully and not with, you know, the sound bites of this was cold-blooded attempted murder or something like that, because it isn't that simple.
Your thoughts, Brian?
Yeah, I think it's so shocking because of the violent nature of what is alleged to have happened, and because it runs against the norms, if you will. Let's just break it down honestly. Two young white girls from Waukesha, okay? These aren't inner-city African-American men getting involved in a shootout in Milwaukee, which is, you know, the norm that we hear about. Only 9%, slightly over 9% of violent crimes committed by juveniles are committed by women, by girls. So there's so many stereotypes that are shattered by this, you know, easy analysis. And it's, you know, this is just a couple miles from my house. I know a lot of people who went to that school as kids and whose kids now play in that park. And the scary thought of the whole thing is, who's spending time with your kids? Even if you're monitoring your kids' internet activities and you're in touch with your kids and you know that your kids have a solid grasp on reality and aren't going to be like this. I mean, this happened at a 12-year-old birthday party sleepover, for crying out loud. This is a very difficult situation for the society to grasp in general. Thank God the girl seems to be making a recovery. There's reports that she's, you know, walking and talking and likes to spend time in the wheelchair instead of lying in the bed and is eager to get better, and thank God that's the case. But this is something that will shock the community for a long time. We hear about crimes in northern Wisconsin that the communities are defined by the crime that it took place. You know, decades ago, something so serious happened that people remember that there for generations. This is the kind of thing that's going to hit in Waukesha. And I give District Attorney Schimmel credit for not grandstanding on this issue, and for, you know, answering the questions, but being subdued and letting the case take its natural course. You know, he is running for attorney general. This could be, in a craven way, someone could say, this could be your platform. You could really exploit this. And I give him credit for not doing that and understanding that justice isn't served by doing that. And, you know, you do your job and people will reward you for it.
Well, yeah.
I don't know how this is going to play out. I understand why they're doing this in adult court. I mean, if you do this, Peg, you would know better than this. But if this is done in a juvenile setting, it really limits the amount of time that we have over these girls, right? By the time
it depends now, because we do have some opportunities now to extend detention past like their 18th birthday, as it was years ago. So there are some alternatives there. I just hope that, like you say, Brian, it isn't politicized. And frankly, you know, we have. I would argue that indeed we have historically a situation where. Let's see, it would have been 2002, it would have been 2006 when Paul Bucher ran in a Republican primary against J.B. Van Hollen, the incumbent attorney general, where Paul used his successful prosecutions on a variety of things, police officers shooting in Waukesha County and other things to sort of show his tough-on-crime kind of thing. And I think in some ways that backfired on him because I think people are looking in those offices where there is such tremendous amount of power, and you've seen it too, Brian, where you need to make certain that whoever's making the calls and is doing these, and making these decisions pretty much without any sort of, with very little supervisory kind of balance there, that person does so in a thoughtful and deliberate kind of way.
Let me add a couple. Let me jump in and add a couple of comments from our listeners. We have Teresa on Facebook who says, "I think they should be tried as juveniles because there is more funding for mental health rehab for them, whether they're in a juvenile prison or in a state mental hospital." But Krista on Facebook says, "Yes, they should be tried as adults. They did an adult crime. They should get the adult punishment." Brian, what about 12-year-olds? Can't they be rehabbed?
Well, I mean, you would hope that there's a chance to rehabilitate any offender, right? I mean, that's the hope. But rehabilitation is not the only goal of the criminal justice system. There is also, you know, justice and punishment for the crimes involved, and making the victims as whole as possible and protecting society. So prosecutors and judges and they constantly weigh these mitigating factors to come to the best solution. I think, as a society, as a system, as this plays out in the system, the rest of society, what can we do about this? Well, we can get a better grasp of who our kids are hanging out with, where they're spending their time, what they're looking at online. And parents, we're all blind. We are all blind. And I don't care if you're in your 30s, your 20s, your 50s, we have no idea. The kids know what's on the internet, and it's evolving every day. And this wasn't some darknet site, and these sites weren't evil in and of themselves. They were fiction sites. But you should still know. I mean, there are shows on kids' network television that I don't let my five-year-old see because I think they're too violent or they glamorize certain things. You just have to be aware. You know, this is not 1970 anymore. You can just let your kids go to the park or watch, a half-hour romper room after school and not worry about what's on there. I mean, parents just have to be more vigilant than ever.
You know, I wanted to ask, I'd never heard of Slender Man or Creepy Pasta. what the heck? And there are some stories now that there was a local administrator of a Creepy Pasta website who apparently lived in Waukesha, but does the website itself bear any responsibility here? Peg, what are your thoughts on that?
I think Brian, you alluded to this, and I can't believe we're in the heat of agreement on all these things so much today, but we can't try to oversimplify what the cause is. You know, there are the people who want to go after the video games. There are the people who want to go after the parents. There are the people who want to go after the kids. There are people who say, society, this and that. I mean, there's no simple equation and there's no one-answer solution. You look at a country like Japan where there are very few homicides and yet some of the most violent video games on the planet are played there regularly by kids. I think that there are all sorts of things that we can do, but doing any one of them or even doing a couple of them in combination is going to give us a guarantee that this isn't going to happen. So, do I think that video games that are violent are bad? There are some bad aspects to them, and some kids can handle them and some kids can't. It's just one of those things of as we sit there trying to seek a solution for something, it's something that we have to acknowledge isn't going to be simple.
Ellen in Brookfield is with us. Hello, Ellen.
Hi. So my question has more to do with the idea of how young do we go trying children as adults? I mean, I think because of the media and our entertainment media, we forget how young a 12-year-old is. I cannot look at that at a 12-year-old and say they are actually responsible for their actions. I mean, we can't let them drive. We can't, you know, they're children. They are absolute children. How young do they have to be before we wouldn't try them as adults? Five?
Well, you know, I thought I read that the state law says you could waive someone as young as 10 into adult court, Peg.
Yeah, there are some states that have 10-year-olds who can be waived. And I think probably one of the things that we can look at that makes sense is studies about brain development and not just knowing what's right and wrong, but how one's brain reacts to doing something or controlling what's right and wrong. You know, we talk about, say, older adults who have Alzheimer's or something like that, some sort of dementia or whatever, where we say, you know, like the filter has gone out and that the things get blurted out that wouldn't have been blurted out 10 years before. Likewise, when it comes to young children, the filter isn't fully developed, and there have been a lot of studies on that, both in the U.S. and around the world, and I think it's something that we have to look at. You know, we're in an information age and a 24-hour news cycle age where kids many times have adult responsibilities and yet don't necessarily have the mental capacity to handle everything that's coming at them. And, you know, and those sorts of things do need to be considered. You know, little 12-year-old kids, I've dealt with them as victims as well as perpetrators of crimes. And you're right, they aren't adults. But that being said, you know, there are a set of criteria that ought to be used in terms of whether or not waiver is appropriate, and hopefully, as this case moves forward, prosecutors will do just that.
And Brian, any final thoughts on this story?
Well, it's a tough call. I mean, if the alternative is we get 5 or 6 years of therapy for these girls, and then that's it, and then they have no record. you know, that doesn't serve society, and I would think you could argue that it doesn't serve those young girls either. So I think as a, you know, a thoughtful approach on a case-by-case basis, but it is troubling, and maybe we need to come up with an alternative where, you know, they're not tried as an adult, but they're also not limited by the juvenile justice system because of the specific nature of the crime. Maybe there has to be something in between. It's definitely worth looking into. But in this instance, you know, let's just thank God for the bystander who basically helped save the young girl's life. And, you know, had she not been able to explain what happened, this would have been hard to piece together, I think. Even though everyone knew where she had been, who could fathom that 2 12-year-olds could have perpetrated this?
We need to move on to other issues. Quickly running out of time, we'll have more on this topic on Monday morning between 6 and 6:50. Cynthia Schuster will be in for the Vacationing Joy Cardine on Monday, talking more about this issue after 6. We'll talk more about the news of the week when we return, and we'll have our Week in Review quiz question. We'll talk mostly about the primary races that are shaping up in Wisconsin after this week's nomination paper filing deadline. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Week in Review. Time now for the Week in Review quiz. Seniors at Wauwatosa East High School recently posted on Craigslist that the building was up for sale for $50,000. Just a few days later, a second Wisconsin high school was posted for sale on Craigslist, thanks to another group of senior pranksters. Which Wisconsin high school senior prank put a school on Craigslist for sale? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Besides Wauwatosa East, which Wisconsin high school was put up for sale on Craigslist by senior pranksters? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We'll give you 5 minutes to call in your answer. We'll randomly select a correct answer from all that come in, and we'll name the winner and the answer at the end of the program. All right, let's get back to the news of the week. Challenges to nomination papers filed by Democratic gubernatorial candidate Brett Halsey and 4th Congressional District candidate Gary George have been filed with the State Elections Board. The challenges were filed by Thursday's deadline for 13 candidates seeking to get on the ballot in Wisconsin. All of the challenges allege candidates failed to submit an adequate number of signatures for a variety of reasons. There were many other candidates here, but let me start with Peg, because I know that you've had to get these signatures. How difficult is this?
Oh, you know, I don't think it's... First of all, I don't think it's as difficult as people think. I mean, you go out and you get them and you find places outside grocery stores or public park areas. You give them to friends and relatives and get everybody to sign. I think the bigger issue is the sort of how do you make certain that a signature is going to be considered valid. And I guess there may be good faith on the part of the circulator or whomever, and yet it may not be valid for one reason or another. And so, you know, that's, I think, the biggest issue. But, you know, when you come in with, you know, where you're supposed to submit, say, 2,000 to 4,000 signatures, and you submit 2,012 or whatever, you know, you're really asking for somebody to go through with a fine-tooth comb and try to invalidate signatures. I don't know. I mean, I guess part of me was not surprised that these two candidates did not get sufficient numbers of signatures, or apparently so, and then perhaps now they have. But kind of that sloppiness in doing something that's so fundamental to getting on the ballot, I don't see it as being something that's excusable.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about some of the specific races there. But, Brian, are you expecting to see any of these bigger-name candidates to be removed from the ballot?
Yeah, I think Gary George probably has a problem. It sounds like Brett Halsey will have enough that he can fix, or might have had some extra in reserve. But I would pay him this. It's not that hard to get signatures. You always have to figure that some are going to get thrown out. You're given a cushion. You should always get more than you need to turn in anyway, because these are people you contact for your campaign. Been doing this for 25 years. It boggles my mind that every 2 years candidates have issues with this. And it's not just those two. State Representative Mandela Barnes may not be on the ballot. There's questions about his residency and the residency of several people who signed his signatures. It blows me away that these things happen. But it's important to uphold the law here. It's important to make sure the signatures are valid. This is a big deal. We want to make sure that the people who have ballot access, who get on the ballot, follow certain measures. It helps the voters, frankly, so that they don't go to the polls and have 175 people to choose from for state assembly. These are people who have a certain, it just shows that you have a certain level of seriousness about what you're doing, but it's not a huge threshold. It's not that hard to get 250, 300, 400 signatures. It's not that hard.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Gary George. You say he might not end up on the ballot, but that was a big surprise to a lot of people. Why do you think he is trying to get on the ballot to challenge 4th Congressional District Congresswoman Gwen Moore?
You know, he is. It's a fascinating case, because he does have a lot of point when he says that since he's been gone from the political scene. Serving time for a felony. But since he's been gone from the political scene, Milwaukee hasn't had a really strong advocate and a really forceful and productive voice, either in D.C. or in Madison. Now, you know, whether he's going to run on the slogan, you know, Gary George, a troubled man for troubled times, I don't know. But it did. It surprised a lot of people, including a certain congresswoman from Milwaukee.
Do you think he'll pick up that slogan, Peg?
I don't know what Gary will pick up for a slogan. You know, he's an incredibly bright guy and did a lot as a state senator in some ways illegally too, unfortunately. I don't think, though, it's fair for Brian to say that Milwaukee has not had a voice. I've known Gwen Morris since she was first elected to the Assembly with me in 1988, and she has been an incredibly strong voice for people in Milwaukee, not just in terms of being a moderate who can work across the aisle when it comes to issues involving economic development in the business community, but also in terms of her advocacy for those who are voiceless. Her role in the Violence Against Women's Act renewal, which was stalled for all too long by Republicans in the Congress, was so significant that she gained national attention and the praise of the president when he signed the bill for being one of the key forces behind getting that legislation passed. The Violence Against Women Act has assisted not just women throughout the state of Wisconsin and the nation, but it has also afforded law enforcement officials, prosecutors, and others to get much-needed resources to deal with what systemically is one of the biggest problems our nation faces, and that's domestic violence. And so I wouldn't minimize her contributions. I don't know what motivates Gary George, although I do think that he is somebody who has had an interest in public policy and certainly has voiced that. And I think because of that, Congresswoman Moore has been right in welcoming him to the race.
Yeah. Well, despite the challenge, Brett Halsey may get on the ballot, the final decision next week, but he's not going to speak at the Democrats' convention this weekend. We had a guest political scientist on yesterday who said that may have been a tactical mistake by the Democrats because he'll get a lot of attention standing outside the building or whatever. What do you think, Peg?
Actually, I agree with Mordecai Lee on this, who I think was your guest mm-hmm. yesterday. Denying attention seekers attention is just affords them the opportunity to create an issue that wouldn't have otherwise been there. I think people who've worked with Brett Halsey and have observed his behavior and observed various reports about him know who he is and why he's doing things. The Democratic Party, frankly, rightly or wrongly, has a tradition of not having endorsed in primary races, but is now doing so. The philosophy before had always been the legitimate candidates deserve to have voice and not, backroom political deals for endorsement. And the legitimate candidates who face not so legitimate competition in a primary should be able to hold it on their own, and why create a scene? And I'm afraid by denying him access, they are perhaps creating a scene that wouldn't otherwise be there.
Brian, do you want to give the Democrats 30 seconds worth of advice?
Sure. It seems to be a coronation, not a convention. At least the Republicans, when they endorse candidates, it's through the vote of the delegates that appear at the convention, thus giving meaning to be a part of the party. I think short-term this hurts Mary Burke because it makes it look like she can't handle running against Brett Halsey, of all people. And long-term, I think it hurts the Democratic Party. What's the point of going to your county caucuses, your district caucuses, and your convention if you don't really have a say?
And we aren't seceding from the union, so.
Well, that's a discussion for another day. It's a time to congratulate Karen in Green Bay. She's the winner of the Week in Review quiz this week. We asked, besides Wauwatosa East High School, which Wisconsin high school was put up for sale on Craigslist this week by senior pranksters? And the answer is Appleton West, my hometown rivals. The the class of 2014 from Appleton West listed the building for sale at $2,014. It also wrote that Appleton West came with the infectious disease that may catch after three or more years, known as senioritis. The strange smell of underclassmen, I guess, is another one. But in any case, Appleton West and Wauwatosa East are not really for sale. Very short on time here, but Peg or Brian, were either of you a part of any senior pranks, or don't we remember?
As the class president of Wauwatosa East in 1986, I will withhold, because I don't know what the statute of limitations are, but I will withhold any comment.
Oh, that is hilarious.
Yeah, statute of limitations is long expired for me.
Yeah, I did. I just went to a park and had a skip day, I think. I don't remember the prank. Anyway, thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peg.
Take care.
Have a good weekend. Peg Lautenschlager and Brian Fraley, our two guests for the Week in Review. Thanks to Robin Sherry and to Bill Martins for producing the hour. Have a great weekend. This is the Ideas Network.